ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher.
As historians, we've spent years digging into the lives of people who've changed history, for better or for worse.
So naturally, we are extremely qualified to gossip about them.
And because they're dead, they can't sue.
In our podcast, we sift through Australia's most notable and notorious characters, giving you our unfiltered takes.
Search the Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The Background Briefing team are working hard on fresh episodes. In the meantime, we've collaborated with ABC Long Reads to bring you some of the best pieces of journalism read by the people who've written them.
Hey there, Madison Connaughton here from ABC's Background Briefing. I want to tell you a story, one I'd heard whispered for years, almost as a sort of ghost story. It's about the disappearance of a Melbourne schoolgirl named Eloise Wallage. But the real story, which I discovered over months of reporting, speaking to family, friends, and police who'd never before spoken to the media, is far more complicated and heartbreaking than anything I'd heard before. This is a piece I wrote for ABC's Long Read called The Girl Who Vanished from Her Bed. This is part one. In the back courtyard of a small cafe on Melbourne's grey seaside, a group of women have gathered around a long table. They have the place to themselves and are locked in intense conversation about the past. The wild 70s, the end of the Whitlam era, when they were all young parents living in a small bayside hamlet called Beaumaris. They're talking about a young girl who went missing back then, an 8-year-old named Eloise Wallage, who vanished one night in January 1976, just a short drive from where they all sit now. The case has since become infamous around this area, a whispered story of darkness beneath suburban malaise. Some of the women here speak almost like amateur sleuths, their voices bright with the hope that if they turn a fact of the disappearance this way or that, something new will reveal itself. But this is no true crime club. Holding court at the centre of the table is Margie Thomas, sharp and serious, an air of Helen Garner about her. Eloise Wallage was her niece and goddaughter, and for nearly half a century, she's pushed for answers about what happened to her. This has, at times, stirred controversy, even within her own family, through which Eloise's disappearance has cleaved a deep scar. Most of the women at the table knew Eloise too, as Ella, the eldest daughter of their good friend Patsy Wallage, who passed away a few years ago. They speak of her as gorgeous, a blunt fringe cut into her sandy blonde hair, and shy too, always trailing behind her younger sister. She was lovely, says Megan Walton, a close friend of Patsy's who had a son the same age. She was never loud or aggressive or rude or naughty. She was just really sweet, gentle. Eloise loved making art, like her mum, and was deeply bookish, like her dad. One friend remembers that a popular kids' magazine, Cricket, sometimes called The New Yorker for Children, was her favourite. She loved to read, which is always a good thing for a child, I think, Margie says, adding, I loved being the auntie. We used to joke about it, you know, the auntie is allowed to spoil, but the parents aren't. Margie has convened this meeting as the 50th anniversary of Eloise's disappearance looms. She wants to organise a memorial to commemorate her niece's life in some formal way. But she has another goal too. She wants to try and push the police to investigate new leads that have emerged in the decades since Eloise vanished. She wants justice, if such a thing is even possible in a case like this. Margie tells the group that, for the first time in decades, the police have just summoned her to a meeting, and they have told her they have some news about the case that she'll want to hear. Sitting quietly at one end of the table is Jane Mervis. In her 80s, she's striking, impeccably put together, careful with her words. She was best friends with Eloise's mother, Patsy, and lived directly across the street from the Woolwich home in the 1970s. She remembers keenly the day Eloise disappeared. She was in her front yard around 8 a.m. when an awful scream pierced the morning quiet. It was Patsy. Patsy came over and said, "I can't find Ella," Jane recalls. While her friend Patsy, an artist and extrovert, was prone to dramatic swings of emotion, this was on another level. Jane followed Patsy across the street, where the young children played together most days, back to the Woolwich's small weatherboard home. "We got up and had a look, and unfortunately her bike was there," Jane says, "because otherwise I would have said, 'Look, she's out riding the bike for sure.'" In the long summer days since Christmas, Eloise had been riding this new bike endlessly. But the bike was there and she was not. She had disappeared from her bed in the night. The morning of January 13 is burned into Margie's mind too, from the moment she picked up the phone to hear her sister's panicked voice. "She was hysterical," Margie says. "She couldn't find Ella. She's gone. Come round, come round." It was a short drive, no more than a few minutes, but Margie says she sped over, still in her pyjamas and a dressing gown. At the Woolwich house, she found Patsy in a terrible state, shaking. Patsy's husband, Lindsay, was there too, seemingly stunned. Though he was always far more reserved than his wife, Margie had never known him to be lost for words. Jane was sitting at the dining table with Eloise's two younger siblings, Anna and Blake. Margie recalls Lindsay had called Beaumaris police station and there was no sign of the policeman there. So she dialed the emergency line and handed the phone to him. He told them, "My house has been broken into overnight and the only thing missing is my 8-year-old daughter." Years later, the police operator would remark that this call stuck in his mind more than any other he received in the job. The lack of emotion the caller displayed shocked him, given the gravity of the crime being reported. Lindsay was still on the phone to police when the local sergeant, Cyril Wilson, finally arrived at the house. "Have you searched the house?" Wilson asked them all. "Children don't just disappear." He was nonchalant, shockingly so given what was about to come. But this reflected just how unfathomable a crime like this was for this time, for this place. "That was why I really liked the area," Jane says, "because it was just so quiet and it was feeling very safe." Beaumaris was a pretty isolated place, she says, without even a train station, where everyone knew their neighbours. Kids would roam from house to house in the afternoons, told only to be home by dinner. Parents worried about their wallets getting snatched at the beach, not their children vanishing. With the clarity of hindsight, though, some are angry about the way the case was treated in those vital first hours. Jane says, "The local policeman was just appalling when you think what he did, tramping around and, you know, dropping cigarette butts and all the rest." For Margie too, this remains a sore point. "The crime scene was basically walked all over," she says. "Nothing was fenced off." Soon more police units pulled up to the Woolwich house, both uniformed and plain clothes. John Bodinar was among them. "I was a detective senior constable at the Moorabbin Criminal Investigation Bureau," he recalls. "I was 27, an enthusiastic young guy with brown hair, not grey." Bodinar had been working in the area for a few years and had always found it pretty sleepy. "We had a lot of shoplifting," he says. "We had a lot of petty crime. We had a lot of crime committed by children." The young detective had never gotten a call like this one before. Lindsay Wallidge, his face dominated by square eyeglasses beneath bushy eyebrows, met Bodinar and his partner at the door. Patsy, slim and tanned, her hair with its distinctive pageboy cut, appeared behind her husband. Bodinar says they were shown to Eloise's room, where the bedclothes were mussed, as if someone had slept there and thrown the covers back to get up in the morning. The thing that wrenched the detective's attention, though, was the fly screen covering the window right next to the single bed. The metal mesh had been cut or ripped and rolled up into the room. The window was wound open to its widest point, and there were a few pieces of tan bark on the ground too. It was immediately clear to Bodinar that this wasn't a kid who'd run away. This was an abduction. He recalls his partner turning to him. "He told me to go out and tell Sergeant Wilson to wait at the front door and not touch anything. But that was too late," Bodinar says. "He'd already touched everything." The police separated the parents and began trying to establish a timeline of what happened in the hours before Eloise vanished. Patsy said that she'd left home after dinner the night before for her weekly jazz ballet class at a church hall just a few minutes' walk from the house. Afterwards, she'd popped into Jane's place for a drink. When she got back home, Lindsay was watching TV. She told the police that she checked on the children before going to sleep, and all of them, including Eloise, were in their beds. For his part, Lindsay, who worked as a university lecturer, told the detectives he'd spent the afternoon drinking with colleagues before getting home around 5:30. He'd played Monopoly with the kids and then watched TV and made some phone calls, going to bed just before midnight. Neither could remember if they'd closed the front door, let alone locked it. Both said the first sign anything was wrong came only the next morning, when their young son, playing at the end of their bed, told them that Ella wasn't in her room. Neither paid much attention to this at first, but then they saw the cut fly screen. Bodinar recalls that the mood with the parents was strange. No one was screaming, crying. You know, "Look, do something, find our daughter." None of that, no tears, he says. "I formed an opinion that something's wrong here." Lindsay and Patsy admitted to the police that their marriage was in a state of collapse. It had been for a long time. They put it down to incompatibility. He was an introvert, cerebral with few friends. She was gregarious, voraciously social, highly strung. And she'd grown tired of her husband's vicious verbal put-downs. After months of shrugging it off, Lindsay had finally made arrangements to move out of the family home. The day before Eloise disappeared, he'd had an appointment booked to sign a rental agreement for an apartment, only to reschedule at the last minute. This, among other things, aroused suspicion. In those first hours, Bodinar says, the case felt solvable. But when he returned to the Wallidge home in the afternoon, he says he found the scene completely transformed. There were police everywhere. There were camera crews there, he says. And as soon as they knew the TV channels were there and that they were making a big deal out of it all the top brass decided they should have their face in it. So they all went down. Margie felt this shift too. "That's when I really knew it was serious when they arrived," she says, "because it wasn't just the local police. It got very big, very fast. I remember being in the car and seeing the photo, the school photo of Eloise, on the billboard outside all the newsagents." The search for Eloise quickly ballooned into the largest ever launched by Victoria Police. More than 200 personnel converged on the small beachside suburb, commandeering the local high school for search headquarters. Officers were dispatched to trawl the vast parks and sports reserves in the area and its scrubby foreshore, thick with gnarled tea trees. Going door to door, they searched properties and questioned locals. Quite a few neighbours reported hearing a prowler on the night of the disappearance. tips poured in from across the country and around the world. But senior police who worked on the case back then now believe that going so wide so quickly was likely a misstep, that resources should have been concentrated closer to home. Some worry things were missed. There are locals who lived right nearby who still puzzle over why they were never spoken to during the search, despite police claiming they door-knocked 6,000 homes. Rob Walton was a friend of Patsy's, and he's the sole man sitting around the table at Margie's meeting. He recalls that a colleague of his who lived minutes from the Wallages and owned a VW camper van, the exact vehicle flagged as of interest by investigators, wasn't even questioned about it. There was a sense of frenzy in the early investigation, Rob says. One day, he arrived at the Woolwich house and was quickly put to work by police manning the phone, with no vetting and no instructions. It was very chaotic, he says. The phone was not far inside the front door, and so a lot of people were coming and going behind my back. Because of the media, strangers were calling the house, crank calls, and a surprising number of older women who told him on the phone, "I've had a dream. She's gone to God." Rob didn't think to take notes. No one had told him to. "That's how naive I was, really," he says. But his wife Megan reflects that, at the time, everyone in Patsy's circle believed that Eloise would be back within days. "I don't think we ever thought that we'd never see her again," she says. "I don't even know whether we maybe thought it was Lindsay, let's say, but that down the track, all of that would be resolved." Other friends speculated similarly in the rare quiet moments that Lindsay had taken Eloise as some ploy to stall the end of his marriage. But they thought that meant she was safe. Eloise didn't come home, though, and her father always denied any involvement. And despite all the intense police resources and white-hot media focus, the investigation soon stalled. In late January of 1976, forensic examiner Jeff Lacuda was asked to re-examine the scene at the Woolwich home. His superiors wanted to know if the original forensic team had missed anything, particularly when it came to the window with the slashed fly screen. Strikingly tall, Lacuda has a careful manner, most comfortable talking facts, figures, and specifics. "The window was one that you could wind out," he recalls. "There's a chain and you can open the window, but only so far. But on this one, you were able to disengage that chain and actually widen the window." He adds, "Around the window, there was a fly screen and that fly wire had been cut and part of it had been torn. It was determined this tear was likely made accidentally by local police when first searching the scene. But using a powerful microscope he borrowed from RMIT University, forensic testing revealed that the cut was made by a blade with red paint on it, potentially a pair of scissors." How the sound of the screen being cut woke nobody in the night remains a mystery to Lacuda, even decades later. But he and his colleague Robert Brown found something else while they were searching the house. A letter, among Eloise's things, addressed to her. Brown described the letter as being some 10 to 20 lines in length with strong religious overtones that referred to her being, quote, saved. He handed it to investigators, but it seems to have then been dismissed by detectives as insignificant. Brown believed they told him the letter was from an uncle in the United Kingdom, yet Eloise didn't have an uncle in the UK. On face value, it was really quite important, Lacuda says, unsure of why the letter was discounted. It appears to have been lost in the decades since. Lacuda's work on the window, though, did have an immediate impact on the case, because he and Brown determined that the fly screen had, in all likelihood, not been cut from the outside, but from inside Eloise's bedroom. The dust on the windowsill was untouched, and cobwebs still hung between the opened window and its frame, which meant it was unlikely the window had been opened further than the chain. How the screen had been cut and rolled up would have been very difficult to do from the outside with so little space. This all added up to one thing. It was more probable that the child was not taken out through the window, Lacuda says. It had been staged. It seems somebody had wanted to make it look like Eloise was taken out the window, but the evidence showed she was probably carried right out the front door of her home. After this story was first published, Victoria Police raised the reward for information that leads to the solving of this crime or the discovery of Eloise Woolidge's body to $1 million. Police have urged anyone with information to contact Crime Stoppers.